First, one question for Felix. I think, yes, you summed it up very well at the end, but going back further into your talk about networked individuality, isn't that also sort of similar to the flexible man? Isn't that sort of about these new individualities which are all demanding of us to become more flexible, and where big sociologists then have made observations which basically are always about a decline? You know, there was once the big identity-forming institutions, and now there's a decline. There's a decline of the quality of the public sphere. There's decline, decline, decline. And I think one of the problems that we have is that we have only a few forums where we can discuss those things in a way which is not culturally pessimistic and phrases everything in this sort of narration of decline. We can do that here. We can actually try create discussions which are much more optimistic, such as yours, despite also obvious objective pressures, which are sort of negative tendencies. Sorry, that was more of a comment, but maybe you would like to comment on the comments.
Very shortly.
I think that the notion of the flexible individual that also Brian has advanced, and of what I tried to talk about, that networked individual, are pointing at the same or a similar trend, but they look at very different aspects of it. The flexible individual looks at how this development is appropriated by, let's say, capital, very, very generally. Whereas if I'm talking about the networked individualism or networked individual, I look at it as a more a set of or a different way to build identity that can be hardened into a flexible personality, but also can really extend more what I see as kind of this voluntary cooperation based on mutual trust. So it's the same trend, but different forces pulling at it.
So at this point, we would already like to open the debate to the floor. Somebody here? It will work.
Okay.
Yeah.
First of all, I'd like to thank all three presenters for a truly thought-provoking debate. But I have one question for Constantine. You are a commercial organization. You deal with private information. Given the news this week that Facebook is launching or enabling Google to gain access to a lot of its data, at what point does a commercial organization make the decision to release its private information? What commercial imperative is there that forces that decision?
I think the question is when, you know, we talked about, you know, the participation is, for many people, is, you know, to be found. And what a lot of people realize is, you know, they may sometimes go to the social networks themselves, sort of to the source to find people, or, you know, I've heard numbers that about 10% of all Google searches are non-celebrity. So even if you take out Britney Spears and all that, you know, are people's names. And so I think the idea is that for a lot of users, if they invest the time into the profile and to make it a good representation, that they would like that to show up when Google, you know, when someone searches for the name in Google instead of other information that they maybe didn't publish themselves or other people with the same name. And so I think all the networks, you know, do give their users the control over whether or not it gets picked up. And I think Facebook even gave the users some advance notice before it happened. So, you know, it's also very limited, but you have control. So I think that's kind of what's driving it. I think a lot of it is when you operate a social network, you're very conscious. It's almost like you don't have a company, you have an organism. It's more like gardening. And so, you know, it's an interplay between what you set out and then how you think it's going to be used, how people use it, and then it's a constant feedback loop, which makes it a very interesting business, to be a part of. But it's very different from sort of running a software company like Microsoft, I would say.
Any other questions? I so. You can go back a bit and you recall some of the other parts of the talks that we had. We didn't have so much space for discussion so far.
If anybody has personal questions, please feel free to ask them.
So far, if nobody has a question, actually I would like to ask you a question. I think you sounded very optimistic about people's power with their own camcorders, making their own videos, uploading them. Felix has shown this picture of the military fighter jet over the tent city of the protesters. What should the protesters do? Should they throw their DV cams at the fighter jet, or?
They'd probably miss. I think the protesters could create videos of their experience and their perspective and put them on the web and get their message out. I don't understand the politics of the situation. I'm not clear what's going on there, but I would imagine if the protesters have valid points and they can articulate them, they can use video, which is the most powerful medium in the world, to get those messages out to a wide audience.
Yeah.
It's much, video is much more powerful than the written word. This isn't necessarily a widely accepted perspective, but I believe it's the truth that you can captivate the attention of more people more quickly and more succinctly through video than you can from photography or the written word.
But what I'm getting at is somehow that on one hand we have this sort of new paradigm of participatory media where people can become prosumers, they make their own media, and that's certainly some level of empowerment. On the other hand, we still have military infrastructures and where the decision makers can do things that are really sort of outside our immediate influence. I mean, if thinking back to people sort of voting with their feet when Iraq was started, in London there were 1.5 million people on the street protesting, but that couldn't stop the government. Maybe Brian, or somebody there, yeah? Or Brian, would you like to comment?
No, there's somebody who wants to say something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what you're talking probably, I think your name, Felix, about sort of the starfish and the spider, the difference between a centralized command and control structure and a different structure. But if you take a look about three generations with the start of television, television started by broadcasting from one to many, and there were many generations that were grown up being spoon-fed what they should see, and now for the first time people have the opportunity to make their own personal choices, and people don't know how to deal with this kind of freedom. And I think there's a tremendous struggle, and it's going to be taking some time for the powers that the internet is unleashing to allow people to begin again to express their freedom, because they've lost self-confidence in terms of their own ability to make proper choices. And I think this is something that's a very valid point to this whole discussion.
I totally agree with that, the empowering aspects of the internet, and yes, we're moving beyond the broadcast medium that created the public sphere as we knew it into one where people can actually, you know, get their own message out and, you know, create their own circles of meaning. And that potentially, you know, enriches the political debate to a very significant degree. So I'm very happy about that. But at the same time, and I think it's related to that, we see an increasing number of areas that are of public concern being entirely removed from public discussion. I mean, mention the word security and the discussion stops. And this is not a coincidence. This is what I think we really have to think about both at the same time. Right? I'm not a pessimist saying that we're all going to be here led into slavery or anything like that. I mean, I'm truly optimistic about the anarchic potential of these media, the people really expressing their own individuality and their own world. But I think the way it's currently developing, it's going only that far, partly because the infrastructure is biased in a way that allows feedback control in the way that Brian talked about it earlier this morning. And it's the same infrastructure, right? And partly because due to a number of historical developments, the state retreats from public debate.
I think that sometimes people want technology to save them or optimistically assume that at some point in the future technology will save us from state controls or some other oppression. But I think that actually technology is a tool that we have to use to help ourselves, and that we can't use it unless we know our objectives. And a lot of the people, I agree with you, a lot of people coming out of a world where they're broadcasted to by television don't really visualize an alternative, and therefore they're not going to pick up these powerful tools and use them to accomplish that non-visualization.
I think I'm going to ask a version of the same question that I asked this morning, and I don't want to, you know, fetishize the word anarchy. But I am concerned about this the optimism that says without any rules, without order, we're going to achieve something better than we had in the past. Because without rules, the bully wins. And so I would like us to be thinking about, I mean, I like the idea of the idealized anarchy where people can, you know, where the world is flatter without, you know, the giants ruling us and enabling us to think for ourselves and so forth. But I worry that if we don't think of the kind of order that we want, then we are going to arrive at the situation where there's nothing to protect those of us who aren't the bullies.
Maybe you can trust.
Yeah, maybe just briefly. I think, again, there's two different ways of thinking about that anarchy, and I don't want to make too much up in this world. I just put it into my talk because he mentioned it. But I think if you look at how this free cooperation is working, how communities in free software or anywhere else on stuff like bilaterals or the work or so are organized, this is not, you know, the bully takes all. These are actually have very sophisticated norms about what does it take to be a member of this community, and if you cannot deal with those norms, there are ways of you know, banning people from taking part in these communities. So this is not about kind of an absence of norms, but actually a fragmentation of the norm base where an increasing number of people within their own networks make up their own norms about what is adequate behavior. So in this sense, I'm not so concerned about either we have or about this being the Wild West.
Were you talking about actual political anarchy? Or were you just using it as a metaphor?
No. I was talking about what is usually within political theory understood as anarchy, which is, to my view, mutual cooperation based on, of, you know, voluntary cooperation based on mutual trust.
And what if 500,000 people mutually cooperate to rob me of my private property?
Well,
I used anarchy as a metaphor for the organization of content on YouTube. I wasn't talking about actual political anarchy.
It happened in the French Revolution.
French Revolution?
Yeah.
I'll look it up. Yeah. But I mean, if we are talking about political anarchy, then that, I mean, I think we need to define the basics of if we think that's a good idea or not before we can say that, you know, everybody's going to do it in an ideal fashion.
If
there's a question, I'd rather take a new question, but okay. If not, I have a comment.
Maybe there, yeah.
Hi. Everybody is talking about no control, self-publishing. Well, Felix is talking about no control. Constantine is talking about, well, everybody should start controlling and not whine about privacy, but who is going to teach us? I mean, being part of a community, okay, that sounds really cool, but who is going to teach us? We have to be part of a community. When do we know what we have to control?
I think the idea of starting with a purpose is really good, and that's something that, again, technology can't take away. I think wherever you participate, you need to really think about what your purpose is, and then everything else flows from that. The other things that we found on LinkedIn, when you kind of look at, you know, there is the LinkedIn network overall, but really when you use the system, each one has a unique view. There are 14 million people on LinkedIn, but in fact there are 14 million unique networks. No two networks on LinkedIn are the same, because they're all based on who you're connected to, and no two people are, you know, exactly the same. So it's and you find that there are sort of areas of the network where people have certain norms and other areas where people have other norms. So one example, one that often gets a lot of publicity because it's a very noisy part of the network, is people who believe that the more connections, the better. And I'm just trying to collect those. And I don't think they fully understand, you know, what the purpose is of LinkedIn, but they're using it for their own purpose. And as long as they don't, you know, interfere with a lot of other users, that's okay with us. We don't want to be too regulating, but they're definitely using it in a different way that's intended. And so, you know, I agree with, you know, the notion that, you know, you have really sort of collaboration that creates rules that are based in certain areas. And so, but they're overlapping networks, definitely.
There's one, somebody over there first, and then second over there.
Hello. Hi, everybody. This is a question I put on to you. Obviously, there are a lot of Americans here, and myself, I lived in the States quite for a while. Now, we're discussing private and privacy. In the States, there's one different expression, which is called comfort space, which is an interesting concept. Now, how would you define comfort space versus privacy in our kind of discussions here? Thank you.
Who would like to comment on that?
I'm not familiar with the term. Could you explain it?
Lots of people. Comfort space is something you walk on the street and people tell you, oh, you know, you violated my comfort space. So it's something, some sort of privacy which is more physical than the privacy we are talking about just right here.
I have now made the observation that young people don't have this notion of this body space. So
no, but many people do. So we are talking not only about, people who are familiar with the internet or with email. We are talking about everybody. I mean, if we want to bring solutions to more people than to us, we have to think about people who have a comfort space. You're right what you're saying, but this is what you face in the States a lot. People who have comfort space. Is that privacy? Is that the privacy, or what part of privacy is that? What are you talking about?
I think this is a very reduced form of privacy.
We have very short time. Maybe we should have the second.
It's an interesting comment. Maybe we have the second question over there, and then we need to wrap it up.
We have to do the break.
Als Richterin bin ich Teil des Staates, und ich gebe recht, dass man dem Staat sehr kritisch auf die Finger schaut, weil dort sehr viel Macht ist. Aber es gibt auch einen Teil des Staates, der sich damit befasst, Schutz des Schwächeren gegen den Stärkeren, wer greift in wessen Freiheit ein und ob man sich das nicht nützen kann, diese Strukturen. Das ist meine Frage.
Okay, I think we should leave it at that. Translate that, Mia Wittmann is a judge, and as a judge she said she agrees that we should be very critical about the state, but the state also offers this opportunity to support the weak or to protect the weak, and that is also, I think, an important part of this whole balance in the discussion. I think we should leave it at that. Our lunch break has already been reduced to 40 minutes because we will start according to schedule, which is 2:30, so try to grab some food. I also make a public service announcement.